and circuits. There's a bunch of different noise reduction circuits that manufacturers throw into these things. A lot of times, noise blankers, I think, were pretty much sort of designed at first to deal with ignition noise problems. That if it caught a aberrant signal that was a different amplitude than the rest of the signal, it would kind of introduce a decrease in the gain until it was masked somewhat. They usually end up with an arc. Bells.
Did we lose night control?
Maybe we did.
Maybe the this is LC circuit went.
Sure, he's rebooting something right now.
His all-star connection goes out and he reboots. He'll be back in a moment. ABC to you.
Okay, until he comes back, do we have any other comments about the LC circuits?
Okay, hopefully I'm back now. I'm sorry, guys. All-Star, it has its own ideas of how things should work. So hopefully, it's making weird noises, by the way, so don't be surprised if I fall off of it again.
Regarding noise blanker, perhaps you're correct about it applying to a mobile situation. The other button I have is noise reducer, and perhaps I just misspoke, because one of them is maybe the noise reducer has the effect of eliminating all the noise except for that particular frequency, but it renders the receiver almost useless to pick up other signals.
Well, you sort of have to understand that you can't get everything in life. Usually noise reduction circuits, in the old days, they were very simple audio tuning circuits. So, if this was 50 years ago, you'd be quite right that they had a lot to do with LC. Nowadays, most of them are digital signal processing chips. So it digitizes the audio and it goes through a set of manufacturer's algorithms to kind of try and make a best case scenario of the main signal that it can find. So unfortunately, the side channels kind of suffer because people want to hear the main channel for the most part. So it depends again on the manufacturer. They all use different algorithms. I love my Flex, but my Flex's noise algorithms are not very good. And I seldom use them. I tend to just train my ear. If you want to, run software in your brain, that can be somewhat more effective than some of these DSP-driven. But they're all digital signal processing algorithms that they use to kind of predict the fact that background noise tends to be random. So it selects out the random noise in favor of the non-random noise that's more likely to be a signal that you're interested in.
And is that an LC circuit type of situation?
No, not at all. This is a very sophisticated computer created. It's an IC that digitizes your audio to bit streams and then takes the bit streams and manipulates them. They do masking and all kinds of high-polluting computational calculations in order to produce them. So, no, they don't use simple LC circuits. They use digital signal processing chips and digitizers and algorithms.
Thank you, Roy.
You're welcome. So, Rich, I guess we've covered the subject.
10-4. Yes, we have. Thank you, Roy.
Okay, very good. Joe, N2IMF, I believe. Are you out there still?
Of course I am. With just a comment. Earlier today, I was listening on the radio, and then I was hearing one side of the conversation, and the guy who, and I don't remember who it was, he was talking to somebody else. I guess he was hearing it from the other repeater. So what I'm thinking is that the link between the two repeaters was not working because I only heard the one side of the conversation and not the other.
Okay, well, that's possible, although, I mean, sometimes links are broken in one direction.
Oh, no, I was just reporting it so somebody could bring it up to the committee, have them check the links.
Oh, okay. I mean, if you really want to make absolutely sure, you know, send out an email to Rich, our president. I don't know if he or the executive board listen to our TechNet every Sunday.
USL, thank you very much. And two, I am a...
You're welcome, Joe. Sam, what can I do you for tonight?
You covered it. I'm now listening and learning. Thank you.
Okay, very good. Brian, you got any questions or comments for tonight?
N2MEH. Let's talk about, let's see. Okay, I have a good one. Okay. Now, we all use SSB, okay? The question is, what about using FM instead of SSB?
Well, some people do. Most people don't, and there's a good reason why most people don't. It's the least efficient mode. It's a full-duty transmission, so even if you're sitting there staring at the microphone speechless, your transmitter is working 100%. Amplitude modulation is close to that. Single sideband is certainly not anything like that at all. If you've ever noticed that if you set everything for single sideband, if you say you want to test to whether you got a tuned antenna or such, you never set it for single sideband because if you set your transmitter for single sideband and you don't talk into the microphone, your transmitter doesn't output anything. So it's amplitude modulation, you know, always produces a carrier. But single sideband is a carrier-less upper or lower sideband version of amplitude modulation. And so it's much more efficient. It uses the energy much more effectively to push out the intelligent signal that has all the data in it. An AM radio transmissions carrier only has the carrier frequency. It has no information value whatsoever, which is why you can inject your own carrier and retrieve all the data in audio form. So it's a matter of efficiency. If you're going to communicate with someone locally, well, frequency modulation is okay because you're not really interested in efficiency, and it provides for a very nice listening to a signal. You're not going to have sound like you've been huffing helium or that you're kind of practicing to be an ultra-baritone because the frequency of your voice doesn't shift. If you're off frequency, the FM carrier might be lost eventually, but it will still be the same voice that we know and love. Whereas I'm sure you've heard a lot of people on single sideband, when they're off frequency, all of a sudden it sounds like you're chatting with Donald Duck.
Perfectly reasonable explanation. I just wondered if there was a way, now this might sound a little crazy, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Is there any way to do SSB digitally, or the equivalent of?
I don't think so. Usually people who use digital modes prefer to use phase shift keying because you have to encode ones and zeros, and phase shift keying is the best form. There are variations on phase shift keying that are used in the cellular phone environment, but I don't think there's any kind of I don't know if you could effectively handle it with a single sideband. If you started to change the frequency of the basic signals, that could screw up the reception. So having not thought of it a great deal, my gut sense is that it would probably be very technically challenging.
So FM doesn't propagate through the atmosphere. It's more direct than AM. Am I correct?
No, they both propagate. It's just that one uses 100% duty cycle of your equipment, and the other one sometimes uses as little as 2 or 3%. If you pause in the middle of a single sideband conversation, your power output goes to zero. So that's more efficient, that it kind of rides the curve of the data that you're sending, as opposed to FM, where it's always 100% on.
So are you saying that it's possible to actually have a skip situation with FM in the atmosphere?
Yeah, there's nothing inherently stopping you from having that. It would just be a less efficient means of using the underlying propagation. You would still have the same kind of propagation effects using frequency modulation that you would with single sideband modulation. You'll get propagation when the ionosphere is charged, and it refracts the signal back down to the Earth once, twice, or three times to get it around the world. So there's nothing inherent in the transmission mode that would affect the propagation, except just the general signal strength.
Okay, well that makes sense. So the only way on AM to increase the clarity of the transmission would be to maybe increase bandwidth as one variable.
No, not really. By increasing the bandwidth, you would increase the fidelity. If you were looking to have a much more reproducible sound than that you hear, in real life, you're limited by the bandwidth of all the signals that you're using. They have an inherent limitation in the range of frequencies from zero to X number of kilocycles. For single sideband, it's approximately 3.3 kilocycles. So you're cramming in a voice that could very well take up 10 kilocycles into 3.3. There is such a thing as extended single sideband, in which you increase the length of each sideband to twice the normal amount, and that will be able to reproduce 6,000 cycle tones. Ordinarily, if you had a tuning fork that was outputting 5 or 6,000 hertz, and you played it on your microphone on your single sideband, the guy on the other end would say, "I don't hear anything," because the bandwidth is approximately 3.3. But you can change that on some radios.
Well, that's pretty fascinating, actually. Extended SSB, I'm going to look that up. I never knew about that. The question is, would the FCC allow it?
It depends where you are. If your band plans have stated provisions for symbol rate and for bandwidth, theoretically, there's nothing really stopping people, except for the hatred of the AM guys, to do extended single sideband there, because their amplitude modulated signal is also about 6 kilohertz. So they'll be very angry with you, but I don't think it will be an FCC violation. Every so often, people will, on the voice modes, play around with extended single sideband. It's taking up twice as much room as you should. Probably the FCC is not going to fine you for it unless you really abuse it, but theoretically, I think you could use the 6 kilocycle bandwidth because that's how people use AM.
I understand. So maybe you're better off just using AM if you wanted to do it rather than single sideband.
KD2FIU.
Well, yes, George.
Yeah, sideband for the amateur radio permissions was moved from 2.4 to 2.8 a few years ago. Maybe 4 or 5 years ago. But that's it. 2.8, beyond 2.8, let's put it this way. Sky's not the limit. 2.8 is the new limit. It used to be 2.4.
Okay, but in practical terms, even on 10 meters, I have seen people, I have a band adapter, so I can see exactly what bandwidth they're transmitting. And more than a few of them are putting out more than that.
And, well, practically, that's improper utilization of the ham radio frequencies that we are permitted. We were given some leeway, and it's now being abused.
And yet, extended sideband, although frowned upon by most of us, is not illegal. People have done it before. They will no doubt do it again. So there must be some wiggle room in that number.
Comment.
Yes, Brian?
On my FT, for example, I could set the parametric equalizer to go to a little over 3,000 if I wanted to.
That's a different thing entirely. The parametric equalizer is an audio filter that simply filters the bandwidth you're presenting to your transmitter. If your transmitter is set for a 2.7 kilocycle bandwidth, you're only going to put out 2.7. Beyond 2.7, it cuts it off sharply. So equalizers are for the audio signal that you're feeding into the transmitter. It's only the bandwidth selector that determines the band that gets sent out through the transmitter.
Settings done.
Say again, someone doubled with you.
So this would probably be in my transmit settings to see if there is a way of making the bandwidth wider or narrower.
Yes, in the transmitter stage of controls, it'll say what bandwidth do you want. Some are fixed, but a lot of them are adjustable. My flex is extremely adjustable.
Okay, just thinking about a couple of things with that. Very interesting. Didn't know about ESSB. I'm going to look into that, just out of my curiosity. But thank you.
You're welcome. I am AC2GS. If anyone else out there has any questions or comments or topics that they'd like to roll around here tonight, please hit that push to talk and introduce yourself.
PC.
Yes, Rich.
Why would you want to adjust the output bandwidth?
If you think you sounded really pretty at 3 kilocycles and 4 kilocycles or 5 kilocycles, you really want those sharp little consonants to be heard like they were coming off of a CD player, That would be a reason. Yeah, fidelity's sake. I don't know if you've ever wandered through QRZ, but every so often I find these guys with an entire rack of audio gear that they're using for their ham radio, which I think is a little bit over it. But, you know, as long as they don't harm the animals, so be it.
It's like they were in a recording studio or something. But are ham radio transceivers, do they usually allow you to adjust the output bandwidth?
Again, it depends on the design of the equipment. Modern day ones, as far as I'm aware, do. My Flex, I can pull it up to 6 and change, probably more if I was crazy enough to want to do something like that. It's just a matter of grabbing a cursor on a computer screen and shoving it a little bit farther to the right.
Can your Flex succeed the FCC rule about bandwidth?
Well, a lot of radios apparently can, but again, I have to kind of peruse the way that it's worded because there are, you know, the guys who are using amplitude modulation are not using 2.4 kilocycles as far as I'm aware. I'll have to kind of double-check that, but there seems to be some degree of wiggle room that's going on, if not written in the law, then passed on word of mouth or something, because there is amplitude modulation with a wider bandwidth. There is extended single sideband with a wider bandwidth. So they do exist. Whether each and every one of them is a complete violation of rules and regulations, I can't tell you. I'm not the lawyer here.
Okay.
A
question?
Interesting. I thought bandwidth filtering was only on the receive side. But, okay. That was my question, Roy. Thanks.
82FIU.
Yes, George.
So AM is still 6KC. Sidebands, we've moved with permissions from 2.4 to 2.8. Whether radios have the capabilities of doing that still does not mean that we go beyond what our permissions are. Just as an example, a ham radio operator can build his own radio, and that radio could be doing things way out of the permissions of ham radio band allocations and permissions of mode, transmission, and band of transmission. We could do whatever we want with building the equipment to a certain degree before it is marketed, but we ourselves can build whatever we want. Another thing is, if it is marketed, we are still to work within our permissions. AM is still 6. Sideband was allowed from 2.4 to 2.8. If you have equipment that goes beyond that, technically, if you are 3KC away from somebody and they cannot communicate because you're working 3 or 4 or 5KC sideband with, technically you have a jam complaint by that person who cannot work. So just as we are to work within the constraints of our ham band frequencies, we could adjust a radio to work anywhere on the HF spectrum that we want. But we don't work outside of that. And we shouldn't be working outside of what we're permitted anyway. Because they are technically not permitted. Back to you, Roy.
A comment, Roy?
Yes, please, comment.
Okay, George is right. You are not liable for building something that exceeds the requirements, but the operator who does operate outside the requirements, he has the problem. I've found cases on that point.
Okay, well, let me read you something. Again, extended single sideband is single sideband that's wider than the 2.4 or what have you. And it says here there were early attempts to make extended single sideband illegal to the amateur radio service due to concerns about bandwidth usage. However, the FCC has consistently upheld its legality, according to www.essb.us. So extended single sideband is a thing. It is wider than the bandwidth stated, and apparently the FCC has decided not to talk about it. And people use it. It's rare, but they use it. Well, I guess that's that. Yeah, I don't want to argue with you guys. It's just, generally speaking, again, I regularly can look on my pan adapter and I can see people kind of skirting, you know, bandwidth of 3 kilocycles plus. So it happens. I realize illegal things happen too, but it's again on the level of illegality. I think it's a very minor infraction that the FCC doesn't really deal with. I haven't heard any people being ticketed and charged money for operating above the standard single sideband bandwidth. You know, if you do, please email it to me. I'd love to look at it.
New topic?
Certainly.
IF shift. I've noticed that it has a significant effect on my ability to hear certain people talk. Can you explain that?
Okay. It's a thing of the past, unfortunately, because it has to do with intermediate frequencies and intermediate frequency stages were very popular in analog radios. Edwin Armstrong himself, who perfected all kinds of things, including frequency modulation and super regenerative and also super heterodyne. And so what's going on is that depending upon how much money you spent and how much the electrical engineer spent designing your receiver, you either have one intermediate frequency stage or two, or sometimes in severe cases, three. And by changing the intermediate frequency, you can alter to a degree the isolation, selectivity, sensitivity of a given signal. That's the short answer.
I have it on my ICOM 745, and it really works.
Yeah, is that you, Howard?
Sam.
Yes, it is me. I have a comment on this subject.
Certainly, Howard. I know, Sam, that you're Sam. I was just talking to Howard.
Well, I'm coming in on All-Star, so it's, you know, mixing with everything. Okay. What is the difference between AM and sideband? It's 2A, 3J, or whatever it is. The only difference is that single sideband has a suppressed carrier. You can run double sideband. That's legal. You can run DSB. You can run single sideband. So if an AM signal can take up 5 or 6 KCs, there's no legal reason why you as a single sideband station cannot take it up. It may not be courteous, but a lot of people are running, you know, enhanced single sideband or improved single sideband. I mean, you can run, you can get, you know, you can get real high fidelity audio out of a single sideband signal if you got the bandwidth. The only difference is you suppress the carrier. That's basically what single sideband is. Now, you can have reduced single sideband where you have a reduced carrier, but not completely. And there have been some AM broadcast stations that have been experimenting with control carrier where they don't talk, there's no energy to save power. Back to you, Roy.
Okay, very good. Yeah, I mean, actually, I would just say the single sideband is suppressed carrier and one of the suppressed sidebands. This is a single sideband by definition. You can have double sideband, as you mentioned. There's all kinds of different lovely permutations. But I mean, this effectively, you know, whether or not Part 95 says that there's a specific bandwidth it has to be, violations are all over the place. And radio manufacturers build radio transmitters that are capable of changing the settings. So it must be kind of wink, wink, nudge, nudge type of a thing. But it's done. Whether it's allowed or not, again, that's up to lawyers, but it's done.
One thing you just said, Part 95. We are Part 97. Part 95 is, you know, Citizen Band, GMRS, and some of the land mobile services. That has a different application. But in amateur radio, we're given a certain frequency bandwidth. We can do what we want with that bandwidth, how we send information. Actually, they want to change, though. In the United States, we go by modes. But in a lot of other countries, they say, okay, you can do whatever mode you want, but this is how much RF spectrum you can take up. But you said 95. We are regulated by Part 97. Go ahead.
I misspoke, Howard. I know it's Part 97. And there's also talk about specifying symbol rate in transmission regulations.
Which the FCC is way behind, because we can get a lot of symbols through it in the same bandwidth. But people do whatever they want to, and the FCC doesn't have all that enforcement capability. You know, they can enforce it, but they got a lot of other fish to fry. As long as you're not destroying the band and you don't have a million complaints, but you got a lot. So they want fidelity. The guys that run audio chains. You listen to guys on the AM on 80 meters. A lot of them are using broadcast transmitters, gates equipment, and they're taking up 5-6 kilohertz. So, what's the difference if a sideband station takes up a couple of kilohertz? If they're running wideband audio, all it is suppressed carry. You know, they're different flavors. They still come under A3 or whatever's A3J. Forgot the mode letters. You know, you've got also FM too, and that's a whole different story. Okay, Roy, I just wanted to make that comment, and you got to be courteous. I mean, a guy can't complain. If a guy's 3 KC's away from you, that may not be interference. Yes, if you're doing it maliciously, that's one thing, but if you have a purpose, like you're running experiments or testing or just running wideband audio, that's fine. What can I say? Back to you,
WD2HW. Yeah, I mean, ultimately, to quote Dictate to RW, we have to be kind to each other, and we have to be thoughtful of what we're doing and how it affects other people. But I don't think that anyone should kind of be arrested and shackled for operating with a bandwidth of 3.3 kilocycles. And like I said, some of the people I know in this area would have gotten arrested for that if it was such a law. So, any other comments on this subject?
Yes. Will the effect of using a wider band increase your ability to be heard?
No, surprisingly, it decreases it. You are now spreading your transmission over a wider bandwidth, some of which isn't really going to be very useful. The human voice has most of the information in the, you know, 300 hertz to 3,000 hertz. That's why the telephone company standardized telephones for those frequencies, and that's why it works as good as it does. If you want to have beautiful fidelity, and you make it a wider bandwidth, if you double the bandwidth, you're spreading the same amount of energy over twice the bandwidth, and so noise in the background is going to get louder because the signal is being weakened by half, and the noise is staying the same. So you're basically doubling the noise by increasing your bandwidth. So it's the exact opposite. You get better sound fidelity, but it's a less efficient means of sending transmissions and more likely to be lost. That's why Morse code is such an efficient mode, because unless you're going at some ridiculous speed per second, per minute, you're going at a point where your functional bandwidth generated from that speed of Morse code might be only 40, 50 hertz. And with such a narrow signal, you have a narrow noise window, too. And so you're piling that information in a very narrow, concentrated spot, more likely to be heard. So when you're operating QRP and otherwise, it's always best to use something like Morse code, where the bandwidth is very narrow and the efficiencies are very high.
That's my case.
Just a quick comment. T2TNT. And
I don't know what to do with this. I think Sam was one of them.
I just said that I asked the question about the efficiency of the expanded bandwidth, and you answered it, and I said, I rest my case, because the goal, of course, is to have a good signal. That is what you're really aiming for with any of these modes of transmission.
Well, I would quibble over the term good. To have a signal recognizable, very often people, especially for contests and otherwise, where you have to grab the other person's consciousness, will crank up the compression and produce a somewhat annoying voice. It would be fatiguing if you had a long chat with the guy, but for a couple of seconds, he becomes demonstrably observed, and so you recognize him, and he gets his points, and he moves on. So it's more a recognized voice than a good voice. Good voices serve other purposes. Okay, I don't know. I've lost track of who these people are, because you know, three or four people kind of talk simultaneously. I think one of them was Ruben. If Ruben was one of them, please say your piece.
Thank you, Roy. This is Ruben Casey, 2TNT. You know, I'm listening. I just wanted to say it's a good net and everything, and I just wanted to see if my antenna could receive everybody. It's receiving it's receiving very well. And, you know, as far as talking about inductance and capacitance and resistance, I know some of that stuff. When you were talking about the antenna tuner, depending on the circuit of the antenna tuner, I have one myself, and it explains the fundamental of it. But I also wanted to say hello to WBH2WW Howard. I haven't spoken to him in a long time. And that's about it.
Okay, very good. Howard, I think you were one of the people in that pileup.
Yes, I was. I was going to say two things. It depends on what the application is. If you're looking to have a pleasant chew, so you want bandwidth. If you're looking for distance, you're going to want to narrow it up. Also, remember, if you're running, let's say, 3.3 kilohertz of bandwidth, and the guy that's listening to you is listening with a 2.7 or a 2.8K receiver, then he's going to lose it, because some of that energy is going to be, it's like, think of it as like a bucket of water. Too much water, some of that water is going to fall on the floor instead of go, you know, into the bucket. So you basically want to have your bandwidth of your transmitter match the receiving end. That's basically what it is. And second, you're right. The wider the frequency, the less sensitive your receiver is. Now, you take the same RF amplifier circuit and you use it on a broadcast station, which is, you know, 150 kilohertz plus or minus 75 kilohertz, your receiver is about 1 to 2 microvolts of sensitivity. You take that same sensitivity, same receiver, and listen to a 8 to 10 kilohertz of bandwidth on a narrowband FM signal, you're down around 0.08. So the wider your signal is, the less sensitive, and the more power you need, because it's called power density over the bandwidth.
Okay, very good, Howard. Yeah, I usually don't adjust my bandwidth for the guy on the other side. I usually have it set for 2.7. Every so often when there's some guy with, you know, 3.3, it's just out of curiosity, I'll open it up to 3.3. And usually I just don't discern any significant higher fidelity, and I put it back to 2.7 where I left it. So, you know, you're free to kind of adjust it. These things are adjustable on the receiver as well as the transmitter. But, you know, I haven't come across someone who's, gee, that's amazing differently. You know, it's usually the same okay sound, not anything special.
Comment?
I can make a comment on that. It all depends on not only the bandwidth of your receiver, the audio stages. And if you listen to something like, okay, you know, you listen on a 75A4, or you listen on a Drake R4B and open it up, you're going to hear the difference. You listen to somebody on a Collins with a Collins mechanical filter, and you put it on the 6K, yeah, you, and the other guy is running good audio, yes, and you got a good speaker, you will notice the difference. Not much, but it's more pleasant. And 3.3 ain't going to make that much of a difference. If you got a guy running 4 or 5K, and I've listened to those guys, and they sound good. I don't have a Collins, but I will tell you, when you do listen on an older radio, like a Collins or a Hallicraftis or a Hamilton, yeah, you hear the difference.
Okay, I've never used a Collins. I used to dream of the day that I would own one back in the late 60s, early 70s. I would go to sleep, and instead of counting sheep, I would tune my Pi network in my imagination. But it was never to be. I like my modern-day radios. And yeah, I mean, it also has to do with the audio chain of the transmitter and the receiver. So there's a lot of variables. And I thank you, Howard. Brian, you wanted to say something?
I think Howard's comment was spot on about the bandwidth mismatch, and that's a very, very, very good point. Morse code is, yeah, obviously Morse code is extremely, extremely efficient. Matter of fact, I don't know if I ever told you guys about the story. Not too long ago, I was at a horse ranch. And there was a horse, I think it was a stallion, that was tapping his hoofs, you know, up and down. And I asked him what he was doing, and he said he's practicing his horse code.
Okay.
Just another comment. I did not own a Collins, okay? I wasn't lucky enough as a kid. I used them at school or at the club station. I remember the Red Cross, they had a full Collins station. That was gorgeous.
Yeah, I could imagine. I couldn't even afford to make believe that I had a Collins radio. I when I was in high school, I dropped $100 on a calculator. And my dear father, may he rest in peace, just looked at it and said that was a waste of money. So you could imagine what would happen if I put myself into debt and came home with a Collins radio. He would have probably smacked me all the way to Staten Island.
Well, what kind of calculator?
It was a Texas Instrument, plus minus.
It's SR-51. I had an SR-50. I had calculators before that, but the first calculator was a 51 or a 50. It was LEDs. It was 1975. That's when I went to college. It had all the it was a slide rule. It had sine, cosine, tangent. I loved that thing. Used that for many, many years. I think it was an SR-51, if I remember right, or TI-51. Yeah, well, I was lucky. I had a Clay 22 Mark II. My father was very good to me. May he rest in peace. That was a high-end 2-meter AM rig. Then I had a Clay Beta that I bought used. But, of course, the Collins was almost the same price as a new house. You had to take out a bank loan for that.
Comment.
Yeah, that... 1 second, Brian. It was, I bought it in, I think around 1970, 71. It did plus, minus, times, divide, square root square. That's all it really did. It had LEDs. It had rechargeable batteries. And I really enjoyed it. I had slide rules as well, but it was much more fun to play with than a slide rule, at least for me. Brian, you want to say something?
My first calculator was an SR-11 Texas Instruments, 1975. My dad bought it for me as a graduation gift from high school. And, no, sorry, not a graduation gift from junior high school. And cost at that time was about $79. So if you adjusted out, you could see how expensive it really was. Now they give them away.
Well, we could go for the next 25 hours about how times have changed. I will tell the story that I have told more than a few times here. Back in, I think, the 80s, early 80s, Kings Plaza, across the street from Kings Plaza, was a computer store. And I used to hang out there when the salesman didn't throw me out. And I still remember they had a nice, shiny new Amiga, and I really wanted that Amiga. I finally bought the Amiga 1000, then I upgraded to, I think it's a 3000, and then the company went out of business. They sold an auxiliary hard drive, two megabytes. Yeah, I had to try and correct myself because it sounded too low, but no, it was 2 megabytes of hard drive, and it only cost $2,000. You cannot buy anything that holds only 2 megabytes. You can barely find a chip that only has 2 megabytes of memory in it. So, I mean, you know, nowadays, I just looked recently, they're selling 30-terabyte hard drives these days for about $600. And again, it's 2 megabytes for $2,000.
Roy, can I make another comment?
Sure, Howard.
I had to get the math professor to allow me to use an SR-51. Yeah, I got that. I had a hard time using slide rules because I always had bad vision. You probably know that. But my first computer I bought, I graduated college, and I wanted an Apple computer. I bought an Apple II Plus, fully loaded, 64K, five and a quarter, whatever they held. I had a printer, FX80. I had the Epson buffer and all of that stuff. And I had an Ovation modem, 3,200. It cost me $5,000. And my father paid half of it, and I paid the other half. But that's amazing that in 1980, I bought an Apple II computer, fully loaded, and it only had 64K of memory. And I was playing around running DOSK, and I used to do, and I also wrote a very interesting program for horse racing. And that's a whole other story with the help of somebody else. But that's the first computer. Now I got a computer that is a million times better for less than $2,000. How things have changed, Roy.
Yes, indeed, AC2GS. I mean, you know, it's the computational capability. I mean, there are some smart watches that have better brains than the computers that we both invested mass quantities of money on. I didn't go quite that top end. My first computer was an Atari 4800 because it had 4800 bytes or something. The most you could address for the chips were 64. So this one had other things taking up some of the address lines. So it had 64 of random access memory. I didn't have a drive of any kind. I had a cassette. So you would take the program and it would generate tones on the cassette, and the practice was to turn the cassette over and record it on both sides because one of the two copies was going to get fouled up no matter what you did. So I had Atari 800.
I had the same thing.
Okay, good. It was loads of fun. I had it controlling my house. It made people nervous. They didn't like automation then. They barely like it now. But I had a touchpad that I used for button controlling to not have to use the keyboard. And I had loads and loads of fun with it. And when I was done with the Atari 800, I bought my Amiga finally 1000. It was a multitasking operating system that even Apple didn't have a true multitasking. And you could do video titling. I did semi-professional, although Babylon 5, the television show, had its special effects done on Amiga computers. So I had loads of fun in the early computer age, and now I'm staring at a computer screen right now as I talk to you.
Comment?
Yeah, we got a comment here. I'm going to give it back to you right here. You know what's so interesting? I did hacking. I wrote programs to dial the phone to go to find only open circuits and find back doors to companies. I could talk about statute of limitations. All the things I did, I was 20, I was a little bit older. I was born in 55. Yeah, I was lucky. I was working. I lived at home. And I went down. And in one afternoon, spent a ton of money. That's all I could say. How things have changed.
Yeah, we talked about this a year or two earlier. I remember I went to a library and I read Esquire magazine article on blue boxes. So I finally finagled. I traded with a nighttime radio engineer for WMCA. He had the two-tone frequencies, and I had the schematics for a new phase lock loop integrated circuit, and we traded those.
I used floppy disks.
Which ones? The 8-inch ones? 5.5-inch ones?
8 inches, and I had to switch floppy disks to do my word processing. It was wild.
Yeah, the first computer I really played with was the physics department of NYU. If you took a physics course, they gave you an account number with their mainframe, time sharing. And so I got that, and I spent a lot of time upstairs in the physics department playing Space Invaders and all kinds of things. They had paper tape. So I had a shoebox. Almost everyone who used those types of computers with teletypes had this. They had a shoebox, at least one, filled with rolled up paper tape.
College, we used punch cards and feed the punch cards into the processor.
I didn't do that because I didn't want people to kind of know that I was there. And you could go into the computer room with the teletype, and you wouldn't have to actually interact with anyone on the IT team. So I would just kind of scurry in there and with my paper tapes and such and have my fun. As far as PDP-8, I did an Ayers chemistry presentation on spectroscopy that used Fourier transform spectroscopy and decoded the numbers and processed them through a PDP-8. So I played around with a PDP-8 for a while.
Are you a little bit old? I don't know how old you are. I'm 70. You must be a little bit older than I am because a PDP, I used a PDP-11, LSI-11N, and LSI-11 chip. Yeah, it had paper tape, it had the yellow tape, and it had 10 megabyte hard drives. Can you believe it? Those cost like $40,000 or $50,000. They had that in the engineering in the electrical lab, and we would do things like run HMAS, which was a program for doing transistor design. You could model the H parameters around the transistor, and we also did. We had a professor that was playing with very basic A to D converters and making music and decoding tones using the computer. Wow, how things have changed. And that was at Pratt. And I also went to Queensboro. But, yeah, they had a Burroughs computer in the science building, and that was all punch cards. Yeah, you remember? You bring the cards in, and you hope you made the program work. And before that, I was at Queensboro. All right, Roy, that's great going down memory lane.
Yes, indeed. I never used punch cards also because if you made one mistake, you didn't find out about it until you ran the punch cards and they failed. So I always liked to play around with teletypes and such. The mainframe that I used in the NYU physics department was an HP 3000A, I believe.
The mainframe we had at Pratt was a Burroughs. It was a Burroughs. We didn't play with it. We just had to bring our, we had to bring the thing in, leave it with the IT kids and the IT tech and come back the next day. I hope you didn't have an error. But then a lot of other stuff we did on the PDP-11. Okay. And then just towards the end of graduating, people were building their own computers using, and I had a class that did the 8080 or the Z80, and that had all the different chips, the UART, the Universal Asynchronous Decoder. I took that as an elective, and that was a course on how to use, you know, all the chips and how to do all kinds of stuff. Wow, can you believe it, Roy? Shows our age.
Well, but it was a good time. If I had to decide, you know, I mean, I don't know what the future is bringing. I'm not terribly optimistic these days. So, I don't know. I think I lucked out. I think I had a great childhood. I enjoyed it. I loved my little popular electronic magazines. I still can remember when the Altair was announced. And I could never afford it, but still a man can dream.
The Altair with all the switches, I remember it. Yeah, I guess you and I were getting Fight Magazine. Well, you know, look, I wouldn't give up that time. I had a great father, had a great family, had a great time at Pratt Institute in Brooklyn. But as far as the future is concerned, Roy, it's what we make it. And you know what? It's up to the guy upstairs. Everything is going to work out. Actually, I'm pretty happy. I'm not going to get into politics here, but you know what? Things happen for a reason. And you know what? Only the guy upstairs knows. That's all I'll say.
Well, but on the flip side of the guys who say God helps those who help themselves, I'm too much a student of history to know how bad a civilization can go. There's practically no limit. So I'm glad you're optimistic because I'm not terribly optimistic. But we'll see. You know, stranger things have happened. You know, maybe people will show their nobility instead of their venalness and things will turn out good. We'll hope for the best. Settle for the rest.
Yeah, you're getting me more into this. All I can say is that we went too far one way. I'm not a socialist. I want to be able to walk around safety-wise. Yes, you have to be careful because look at what happened in Germany. I also like history. But part of what happened in Germany was because of what we did in World War One. We destroyed, we completely destroyed Germany, and they had inflation and the Weimar Republic, and you know what happened. Yes, you got to be careful, but we also have to look at. You can't have everybody coming into this country. All right, enough of that. But yes, you know what? When we were growing up, we had problems too. We had the SDS, we had Vietnam War. I remember they were putting up the protest, but guess what? We had the Apollo, and that was excellent. I can still remember where I was when Apollo 11 landed, July 20th.
Yeah, there were good things, there were bad things. When you look through the long lens of long life, he tends to be rather rose-colored. You tend to remember the good things, hopefully, better than the bad things. But, you know, I mean, there's always going to be some bad things. There's nothing much you can do about it one way or the other. But we'll see what time how things develop. And, you know, I'd like to kind of move on from this. And, you know, anyone interested, the political net will be on at 3 o'clock in the morning. And you're welcome to it.
What frequency?
What, Sam?
Said what frequency? I'm just kidding. I'll tell you the truth. I believe that we are really at a peak in our civilization at this moment in terms of our lifestyles in America.